Gary Pippen, and we're broadcasting from the UFO Congress at the Aquarius Casino Resort in Laughlin, Nevada, on the Colorado River. We have Ralph Ring with us, and Ralph, of course, if you looked at our website, we have a link over to Project Camelot, where you did an interview with our associate, Kerry Cassidy, and Bill Ryan, both of them, and you did something this morning here at the conference.
I did. I hope it went over good.
Well, it went over great. People were talking about you and your flying saucer machine, and we'll get right to that part of it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Tell us a little bit about that, what you talked about here this morning.
Well, I told them a little bit about me, backgrounds, so they'd get a handle on who I am.
I think it's a good format. We'll follow that.
Okay.
Who is Ralph Ring?
Well, I'm just a guy that was raised in the woods. Most of my life spent in the country, and my sister and I used to walk 7 miles round trip to a one-room schoolhouse up in Paradise, California, which is near Chico, California. And while I was doing that, I learned about natural law. Everything that we studied was telling us how things really worked. And one of which was an anthill that I pestered with a stick to get a rise out of them, and they stung me half to death. So I learned.
You know, you and I have a similar childhood experience. I set him one time trying to dig around on it, and that was not the thing to do.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You don't mess with Mother Nature.
Yeah, right.
I found that out. And so it taught me a big lesson, and I learned to respect them, and I went back and apologized. And after that, I never had
literally apologized to the ants.
I literally apologized to the ants.
Well, see, you're a smarter guy than me. I didn't think about that.
Well, they must have heard me because I never got stung again after that. I eventually had deer that I could have eating out of my hand, and squirrels running all over my body looking for peanuts. And so I got familiar with the way, the rhythm of life. It's a natural flow. Mm-hmm. And it's quite different than the life I led later when I got into the military and out into to public domain. From there, let's see, I should have brought my notes.
That's okay. I'm sure it'll come to you. It's kind of like me. I started thinking about it. And you mentioned the military.
I went into the military in 48. At Fort Ord, California. I was in the U.S. Army. I put in for engineering school.
In the 6th Army, huh?
No, it was the 3rd Infantry.
Okay, okay.
3rd Infantry. And they wanted to keep pushing me back in the infantry. And I kept putting in for engineering school, and it never worked. So they shipped me out to a little island in the Pacific called Guam, and we were there for a while until the Korean War thing came up. And in the middle of the night, they got us out of the sack and told us we're hitting the boats and we're going to make a Wonchon landing in North Korea, which we did. And it was I hate to say enlightening experience, although it was an experience I'll never forget. Because I got familiar with what killing was all about. I was in my outfit was the 3rd Division of the 7th Regimental Combat Team, which consisted of heavy machine guns, heavy mortars, 4.2 mortars, and 1.55 howitzers, big guns.
So when you were talking about a killing machine, you're not exaggerating?
No. No, and I got up, I was on the front line, we were the front line soldiers, we went out on patrols, and a lot of us got wiped out on the patrols, and I think I was one of 8 that was left out of 30 of us that were originally sent there, and I got wounded 4 times, I had frostbite in both feet and hands, and it was an experience that taught me what killing was about. And I had decided all the time I was there I would shoot when told to, But I seemed to miss my targets. I never hit a target. I would just seem to shoot up in the air or something. I don't know how that happened.
But
I don't have any. I don't feel I've ever killed anybody in the military. And I know that doesn't sound very patriotic, but I was reinforcing our unit in other ways and reinforcing the whole platoon. I was a platoon leader at that time, and I made sure that everybody was doing their job. So anyway, I got out of there and came back and got discharged, and they were... I didn't know what to do. I said, well, I didn't get to engineering school. They taught me how to kill.
And they don't really apply for those jobs.
Nobody was hiring.
Yeah, right.
Nobody was hiring. But while I was on Guam, I got into skin diving. I used to go down to the beach, and I'd go underwater, and I got really familiar with nature and all the underwater life. So when I got back, I landed in San Francisco and started a skin diving business that went very well. Rapidly overnight, it progressed into become quite a business. And my relatives lived down in Newport Beach, California, which is down south by
right.
Know
where it is? I used to do a show down there.
Oh, okay. Wow, you know where it is?
Yeah, right.
So I went down to join my.
I was actually on the border of Newport Beach and Costa Mesa, but I know where it is.
Okay. Well, my relatives had quite a bit to do with the real estate development in that area and so forth. And but I was on my own. I kind of...
Well, it's a good business to be in, especially back in those days.
Oh, yeah. They had the Irvine Coast Country Club. They had everything kind of in their pocket.
Uh-huh.
But from there, I met my wife, and we got married, and... got a little home in Costa Mesa, California, and had a couple of kids, and moved on. I continued my diving, but it progressively got to where I was staying out longer and diving deeper. And one time, a diving boat came up close to ours, and they were from U.S. Divers, the Jacques Cousteau U.S. Divers Corporation, and asked me, they'd heard about my diving experience and my research in the underwater technology, and they just flat asked me if I would like to become a part of their research and development department, which I accepted right away. I figured
sure.
Better pay and
right.
More security, and I could stay around the kids more. So I accepted the job. I got into my job, and we modified and changed many of the existing technologies, and then they came up with a mask, a wraparound mask that was my baby. I had to find a way to perfect this mask without distortion that would go down and withstand 200-300 foot depths so that you could see without distortion. So we went out for...
Sounds like you did pretty good with that, going to engineering school.
I seem to be progressing along. Just, you know, I don't know how I did it, but I did. And I was always inventing little things for them. How to control their products and their consumer goods and everything. And so they called me in one day, and they asked me if I would consider being a head diver on a Calypso 2 that they were going to put on the Pacific coast. The Calypso 1 was on the eastern coast.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, sure, when? They said, well, it'll be a year or two, but we'll keep you in mind. Well, the voyages out to Catalina Island and beyond were getting more and more extensive. The diving was getting deeper and deeper. I had a couple of close calls out there in diving. And my wife...
By close calls, you mean you went too deep or whatever? Or?
Well, I had forgotten. I thought my tank was full. I had good, big tanks.
Well, that's something you wouldn't want to forget.
No. But I thought they were full because when I checked the gauges, they said full. But when I went down, over 250 feet, which requires a hangout on the way up so you can decompress. And I suddenly realized I was getting very low on air.
And you couldn't hang out much.
I couldn't hang out much, so I came up just exhaling.
They get you bins?
No,
something?
I never got them.
Yeah,
okay. I was lucky enough to get up fast enough, and I got out of there. But when my wife heard about it, she said, no, that's it. The kids want a dad, and you need to be closer, and you're getting into too much danger. And I found an ad
In
here.
Other words, the wife put the foot down.
She sure did. She stomped me. So she found an ad in a paper that was from Advanced Kinetics in Costa Mesa, California, that was advertising for a laboratory technician. And she said, why don't you go down and apply for that? And I said, well, I got no credential, no academic. I'm a heavy weapons man in diving, that's all. And she said, no, you're tinkering, which I used to do 24/7 in the house. Mm-hmm. I was always tearing something apart. And my fundamental interest in life has been magnetics, magnetic power, and anything to do with magnetics. So she said, go down and put in an application. So I went down, and it was at lunchtime, and nobody was in the hostess and everything were out to lunch. I walked down the hall, and I went by the director's office. His name was Dr. Weinhardt, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for a job. And he said, well, come in. They're out to lunch. Sit down. What's your credentials? I said, I learned how a bumblebee operates. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I was on the second floor of the science class at Santa Cruz High School when my physics teacher, he was teaching physics, was saying bumblebees don't aerodynamically, they can't fly. And at that moment, I looked out the window and there was a bumblebee hovering right, looking me square in the eye. And I had to make a decision to go back to my natural life, which was learning from nature, or listen to this guy that said it can't be done. There's no such thing. Well, later on I found out both was true, that bumblebees technically don't fly, but bumblebees do levitate. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's because that's a question that every high school science teacher brings up.
Well, I learned it from Arthur Aho, who was a brother of Wayne Aho, who worked with us with Otis Carr in Apple Valley. And he wrote a book, Tomorrow's Energy Need Not Be Fuel. And in that book, he explains how bumblebees levitate. And there's a little hollow cavity next to their larynx that once they start the beat of their wings, they start increasing the frequency until they match the surrounding frequency, and in this case, the Earth's frequency at 8.5 cycles. And once they reach that frequency, this waves go back and forth in this cavity, and they resonate. And they reach what you could call a zero point. They nullify the gravity around them, and they create their own force field around them, and they become a free agent from gravity. I later learned that hummingbirds and some lizards, there's a lot of animals that do this already. They actually operate on a different natural law than we talk about.
And I have a hunch this is going to come in handy later in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The reason I say that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back and find out how we get to bumblebees to zero-point energy and going from point A to point B in nothing, actually nanoseconds, I guess.
Yep, nanoseconds.
We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Congress on JerryPippin.com.
It looks like like it's about 8 or 10 miles west.
We're here with Ralph Ring, and maybe, in fact, many of you have watched the video of Ralph and the interview that Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan did. So you have a general idea where we're going, but for me, this is very interesting. In fact, Ralph, I had not realized that's how the bumblebee did it.
Yeah, that's the way they do it.
Yeah. So we're going over the background of Ralph Ring so you can understand what we're going to be talking about here in a minute.
Well, it was my interest.
So did the guy give you a job?
Oh, yeah. I told him, I said, I learned most of my stuff from lizards and birds and bumblebees and stuff. And we talked for quite a while about natural law. And every conventional law that he brought up, I could counter with a natural law that would work, where his ideas were coming short of an operational completion. And one of which was live water coming down a hill from a mountain. Nature neanders it and refreshes it every 2 feet with nitrogen and oxygen. And when man transports water, he does it in a straight line down a viaduct, and it's all dead water. There's mm-hmm. nothing. There's nothing. Life. Fish don't even like it. They jump out of the water. They don't like that kind of water.
So they got to breathe.
Huh?
Fish have to breathe.
Yeah.
They can't do that with dead water.
And they need that nitrogen. They need uh-huh. the life forces. So anyway, he said, okay, I'll tell you what. I said, well, I haven't even filled out an application. He said, no, we'll do that later. Last week, my man working on magnetics happened to leave, and it's just coincidence that you showed up and your interest is in magnetics. I'm going to put you on the magnetic project. I'm to work tomorrow morning.
This must have been a dream for you, dream job.
I thought, well, this is it. This is where I'm, going to feel pretty good. So they did. They gave me the job, and it was I had a workbench, and I had a giant oscilloscope with a high-speed Polaroid camera and a cathode ray tube that was firing electrons down through a magnetic field. And my job was to get from point A to point B without deflection. And so that's all you have to do. And I sat there day after day taking hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of these silly electrons being deflected to either the positive mm-hmm. or the negative side of the magnet. So I was getting kind of bored because they were telling me to just keep giving it as much force as you can. You've got to get this going because we're working on a project for the government. This was a government-funded research laboratory doing very, very quiet work that the government wanted them to do. He said, use as much power as you want. Well, I took that into consideration. Then I looked over on the next bench, and they were working on levitation. They had these giant coils and, iron coil with mm-hmm. copper windings.
Right.
And they would levitate steel balls for about 8 minutes and burn up the coils because they they put too much power to them, and they just shorted out. And they didn't worry about it because they could go to supply and get another one. And these were about $400 a piece, and this was in about 55. That was
a lot of money, right.
But they said, don't worry about it. We've got plenty of money. So I was curious about that. And I had, through my interest in nature, found many other ways to do things, and one of which was levitating and one of which was getting things to work without force.
Are you talking like the bumblebee example?
Example. Yeah,
right.
Uh-huh.
Okay, something like that.
Where you don't have to propel the bumblebee through space. It just levitates on its own mm-hmm. frequencies. It creates its own frequency and resonates to its environment.
Back in your mind, you were probably thinking, these guys are wasting a lot of time.
I did. I did indeed. So to make a long story short, I went home and tinkered around, and I built a miniature setup that I had at work. I had a cathode ray tube, and I took it out of an old TV and magnets, and the thing I did was what I learned from nature neandering the water down through a gorge mm-hmm. that I used to frequent when I was a kid. And all I did differently was pulse the signal. In other words, I allowed the electron to spiral. And
okay.
it spiraled from negative and positive, never touching each one, but it went all the way through to the target. The first time and every time thereafter, for about 20 or 30 more times, I never had any trouble. So I took pictures of that. I wrote up the experiment. And then I got on the levitation thing. I took a 15-inch woofer speaker and put it on the carpet in my living room floor, attached an audio amplifier, started increasing the acoustics,
yeah.
the sound
okay.
waves, and I finally wound up with a ping pong ball. And I went up to about 28,000 cycles and found that the ping pong ball would suspend itself in this 15-inch.
In other words, at a 28,000 cycle tone, the ping pong ball was levitated.
Right. I'm not sure of the exact frequency. It might have been 29, it might have been 27, but it was around there somewhere.
In that area.
And so, as usual, it was late, and my wife said, come to bed, and I left it overnight. When I woke up in the morning, it was still levitating.
So it's longer than the 8 minutes with the ball bearings
they
were doing.
Stayed right. there all night, no noise.
Right, right.
There wasn't any heat involved. There wasn't any of that. It was acoustical levitation, and I'd heard about the Tibetans using sound waves to raise rocks up the side of mountains and stuff. So it didn't sound impossible to me. It sounded very, very logical, or very possible anyway. So I wrote that experiment up, along with the other, took pictures, went into Dr. Weinhardt's office, and I was expecting a raise. I thought he'd give me a raise and a promotion and everything. I thought, I solved your problem here on both
yeah,
of
right,
these
right.
things.
Yeah, right,
right. And
I guess you didn't get a good reception because there's no need for more funding. Is that what we're getting to?
Well, well, he says I know what I didn't think you'd get there. He says I know it's that simple. I know what you're doing. He was a PhD. He was a very famous German scientist. He said, I know it's that simple, but this is a government-funded project, and they pay us to look for answers, not to find them. And that blew me completely out of the water. I just couldn't comprehend what he was saying. And he said, "Yep, that's the way it is. This is maybe down the line in 20, 30, 40 years, but he says this is not where we're at. I'm going to shred this, tell you to go back to work, and forget about this. Don't even talk about it. Just
wow."
So I was struck down to the ground. I couldn't believe that. I thought I was going to make my mark in life. You know.
Yeah, I mean, logic would tell you. Aha, I solved it.
Yeah.
But it was illogical because that's not what they were interested in.
No, and I explained to him, I said, now I just did this on my living room floor with about $50 worth of stuff. If we get those engineers in there to work on this and we get together, I think we can come up with some super stuff. And he said, nope, don't talk to them. I don't want you to do anything.
Mm.
So I went back to work. I worked 2 more weeks and I couldn't stand it. I quit. I couldn't take it anymore. That was the end of that. So I started talking to other people about my experience, and I ran into a guy that was part of a group called Understanding. It was originated by a person called Daniel Fry out of California. And they would meet weekly and brainstorm and work together trying to understand where we are in our technology, where we are in our psychology and everything else. And I was talking to this guy, and he said, well, you sound like a bunch of people that I meet with. Come on over and talk. I said, okay. So I went over there, and I started talking about levitating bees, and my dream in life is to get floating homes, that everybody has their own home. that is
off run, the ground.
Off the ground. Mm-hmm. It's run by magnetic power, which uh-huh. is so simple that they've overlooked it or they've concealed it, one of the two, because it's absolutely, utterly the simplest thing in the world is levitation. But they, for some reason, aren't using it. Well, I found out later, and along with the backslash I got from Dr. Weinhardt, that they really don't want any technology that doesn't make money. So they said, well, we got another guy that's along in the same, on the same page as you. His name is Otis T. Carr. He's in Oklahoma. He's in Norman, Oklahoma right now, and he's having some problems because they don't want him to go any further. He was demonstrating, starting to demonstrate his crafts. He was building small circular foil crafts, and he's in trouble. We're going to bring him out here to meet you, and then we're going to find a place for you guys to go ahead and develop this out here. We want to get this technology out. So they did. They invited him out. He brought his entourage with him. He had about eight his engineers and public relations. Wayne Aho was with him, Dennis Ripoldi, a lot of people that were in those days known. They aren't mm-hmm. known now. They all came out, and they put us up at Lake Arrowhead in one of the cabins that one of the people had in the group and said, just hang out here for a while until we get you a place to work. Well, that's where we were, and we brainstormed night and day up there, and I got into some discussions with Mr. Carr that were phenomenal. They were just absolutely...
Otis later became your partner, right?
Yeah.
And he's passed away.
Yeah, he passed away.
Yeah. Okay, so you're up in this cabin all the time, brainstorming,
mm-hmm.
and you got a relationship built up with him and the others.
Right, and we talked about natural law. Uh-huh. Everything that he had learned. He was a protege of Nikola Tesla. He worked with Tesla for 3 years in Baltimore, Maryland, and Tesla had tried consistently, after being working for Westinghouse and Edison companies, to convince J.P. Morgan, who was the backer at that time, the funder at that time, that you don't need any wires to transmit electricity. We're living in a sea of electricity, and you don't need all these wires and telephone poles. And J.P. Morgan said, "Now wait a minute, Tesla. You're interrupting the copper industry. You're interrupting the lumber industry." And what are you talking about? Well, he said it's kind of like a free energy, because you can put a pole on the ground 30 feet and up in the air 30 feet, and you can draw in enough electricity to run your whole household forever without any pollution, without any noise, and most of all, no meters. Well, J.P. Morgan didn't want to hear that. He said, no, this is a monetary system, and there's no money in it. And we're not going to do that, Tesla. So, and he had built one very functional laboratory in Colorado Springs, where he had already demonstrated this wireless transmission of electricity. He could light lights mile, 2 miles away, and light them up, and no noise, no pollution, etc. But
About what year was this, I wonder?
Oh, God, I don't remember.
Probably.
I don't remember.
It could be in the 30s or 40s.
I think it was earlier than that. Well, maybe the 30s, I think.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, anyway.
The point was, we've had this for a long time.
Yeah. And it kind of broke Tesla's heart, because all he wanted to do was help mankind have a better life.
Right.
And when he met Carr immediately, they came together as good friends, and Carr was a sponge. He loved science, and he got close to Tesla, and Tesla taught him everything he knew about natural law. and told Carr, I'm not going to be able to make it in my lifetime. People like Morgan are out there that don't want this to happen. So you take it in your lifetime and go with it and run with the ball and see if you can make a touchdown. And if you can't, pass it on. And if they can't, pass it on. But this has to be someday, because they're going to run into more trouble than they realize. They're chasing their tails, and they're going to destroy themselves. They're on a destructive course.
Well, you're certainly probably right on that. We're getting closer, aren't we?
Yeah, we're getting very close now. Well, yeah. The bees are leaving California.
So it's not long.
No. So anyway, it was passed on to Carr, and Carr went ahead and developed the technology to build spaceships. And when he was had trouble in Norman, Oklahoma, with bad press and everything, they said, let's get him out here, because they're going to shut him down. And he had many, many threats against his life and everything. So we got a call up at Lake Arrowhead.
Well, I can certainly understand that, since I'm a native of Oklahoma. But you go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, we'll be right back with Ralph Ring. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
This didn't look like anything I've ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.